The book of Deuteronomy is a very simple book. It's not a book, it's a speech. Most of it is a speech. It's actually three speeches put together in a structure of one speech until almost the end of the book. And then there's a song, Shirata Azinu, and then there's a blessing, and then it's over. Moses dies, the people of Israel enter the land of Israel. So it's a long speech, and then it's a song, and then it's a blessing, and then it's over. And this series is going to be about the speech, about the last speech of Moshe. And this speech was recorded, documented, and turned into a book, the fifth book of the Torah, the fifth book of Sefer Dvarim. Now, as everyone that's watching and listening knows, the Bible, the Torah, has a narrative. And the narrative starts with Exodus, leaving Egypt, wandering around the desert for 40 years, and then entering Eretz Canaan and founding a monarchy. And the book of Deuteronomy is at a moment of transition. After they left Egypt, after they were wandering the desert, and right before they enter Canaan, right before they enter the land of Israel. And so it's after and before, at that liminal, at that critical moment, he delivers this speech. Now, this speech has a structure. Most of the speech is one idea, and it's very simple. If you will violate the covenant, Moshe says to them, you will fail, your sovereignty will collapse, you will be destroyed and exiled. That idea appears again and again. It's an extremely repetitive speech. If you violate God's words, if you violate the covenant, you'll collapse and you will be exiled. But it doesn't really describe the entire book. How will it feel? How will it look like in details, the moment of destruction? He just says, you'll be destroyed. He doesn't say how. That's until chapter 28. And then in chapter 28, the portion of Ki Tavo, then he becomes very graphic, describing exactly what's going to happen and how it's going to look when their sovereignty collapses, when destruction will happen, and when they will leave to exile. And what I would like to do at this opening moment of these sessions is to read some parts of his violent description of the future, of the day where everything that will collapse. How does he understand, how does he see the future catastrophe of this project? And I'm going to be reading some verses from Parashat Ki Tavo, from the place, the moment in the speech where he describes the catastrophe. I'm not going to read the entire catastrophe. I'm going to read some verses, and I think that the people who are listening here and who are watching from home or from wherever they are will be able to pick up an important rhetorical move that Moshe, that Moses, is doing. So he says, and I'll be reading this, by the way, in Hebrew, and feel free to follow me in English, but my hunch is that it'll be more powerful if you listen to this in Hebrew, partially because it was written and delivered originally in Hebrew. So in verse 21, he says like this, Yadbek Adonai Becha et hadavir ad kaloto otcha me'al adama. A plague of davir, of devir, is going to attack you. Ad kaloto otcha. Until you are almost destroyed. Not completely destroyed, but almost destroyed. I'm skipping to verse 27. Yakecha Adonai b'shchin Mitzrayim uv'tchorim uv'garav. Shchin. Like you're going to have this disease called shchin. And then it says tchorim uv'garav. I don't know what garav means, but it doesn't sound good. And I'm not sure I want garav. It doesn't sound good. Uvecharas, asher lo tuchal lehirape. Verse 28. Yakecha Adonai beshigaon vebeivaron vetimahon levav. So you'll be, it's like, you'll feel like you're blind and confused. In verse 29, V'hayita mimashesh batzoraim, ka'asher yimashesh ha'iver ba'afila. You'll be like a blind person, and in the afternoon, it will feel like it's very, very dark. I'm skipping to verse 38. Zera rav totzi hasadeh. You might be successful agriculturally and have a lot of fruits. Zera rav totzi hasadeh ve'me'at ta'asof ki yechasleinu ha'arbe. Even when you'll be successful, you won't be able to enjoy the fruits of your success because the arbe, like a plague of grasshoppers, is going to attack and destroy the fruits of your hard, hard work. I'll stop here. I think it's possible to pick up an important rhetorical move that Moshe is doing in his speech. He's saying, one day, if you violate the covenant, bad things are going to happen to you. Among the bad things, Shechin, Dever, Choshech, Arbe. What is Moshe saying? I think he's trying to trigger a deja vu in the hearts and minds of the people listening to him. I think he's trying to say, remember the plagues, remember Aseret HaMakot, remember the 10 plagues. Well, the plagues are back. The plagues are coming back. Just so Exodus, that great drama, is not only a part of our past, it could be a part of our future, but there is one fundamental difference here. Last time, there was that big drama with the plagues. Last time, those plagues were directed at the Egyptians. And the entire purpose and point of those plagues were to redeem you. Next time the plagues come back, next time the makot chozrot, when the plagues come back, they won't be directed at the Egyptians. They won't pass over you. By the way, that's why we call it Passover. They won't pass over you. They will be directed right at you, which means in the past the plagues redeemed you from the Egyptians. When they come back, God says, I will treat you as if you are the Egyptians. This is a powerful rhetorical move, which I think captures a very important idea in the theology of Deuteronomy. The powerful idea of theology of Deuteronomy is that the people that left Egypt and entering Eretz Canaan and entering the Holy Land, they have to be very careful that the kind of society that they will create, if they will create a society that will look like the Egyptian society that they've escaped, what will God do? God will treat them as if, just like he did to the Egyptians. The people who left Egypt, and this is obvious in the book of Dvarim, in the book of Deuteronomy, there is an anxiety. The worst nightmare is to return to Egypt. Twice when Moshe wants to say to them that God will punish you, he says, you'll return to Egypt. No one wants to be a slave again. No one wants to be powerless again. But I think here, he's adding another fear. There is the classic fear of returning to Egypt. Moshe is adding another fear, the fear of becoming Egypt. Just like you have to do everything you can not to return to Egypt, you also have to do everything you can not to become in Egypt. Now, the fear of not returning to Egypt is a classic fear. You don't want to be weak. The fear of becoming Egypt, you don't want to be too strong. The fear of returning to Egypt is the fear of someone else's power. The fear of becoming Egypt, that's the fear of you abusing your own power. Starting to understand the world of Deuteronomy is understanding that Moshe is trying to inject two different sets of anxieties in the hearts and minds of the people of Israel. To fear someone else's power is important existentially. To fear your own power is important spiritually and psychologically. Throughout this set of lectures, I will ask, okay, how do you create a society that's powerful and successful, but is not in Egypt? But for now, let's leave it here. That one of the purposes of Yetziat Mitzrayim, one of the purposes of escaping Egypt, is to create a society that is the opposite of Egypt. That is the antithesis to everything that Egypt represents. And with that guiding line, this makes room for asking the obvious question. What does Egypt represent? Well, many things. Many things. And throughout the series of lectures, I will try to introduce how, in the last speech of Moshe, he tries to create a politics, a political system, and a political way of thinking that is the opposite of the Egyptian politics. And a theology that is the opposite of Egyptian theology. But for today, for now, for these opening remarks, I want just to tap in to something else. And that is, how does Moshe Rabbeinu treat the Egyptian tendency to glorify leadership, to glorify the personality? Because this is the part, I think, that Moshe takes very seriously, because for him, he also takes this very personally. Moshe was raised as an Egyptian prince. And there's a lot of Egypt, there is an Egyptian in Moshe. Anyone that read the book of Exodus knows that when foreigners in Midian bumped into Moshe, it was Zipporah and her sisters. They come back to her father, and that they describe Moshe. And how do they describe him? They say, Ish Mitzri hitzilanu miyad ro'im. An Egyptian man, an Egyptian person had just saved us. Because when they saw Moshe, they saw an Egyptian. He didn't have to say anything, but he radiated Egyptianness. Maybe it was his body language. Maybe it was the way he talked. Maybe it was his accent. Maybe it's what the way he was dressed. They saw an Egyptian because Moshe was an Egyptian. And in what sense, Moshe that has to create the opposite of Egypt, and he himself is the son of Egypt. How does he do that? Well, the Egyptian culture was a culture that glorifies power and glorifies and worships the people who own power, and especially political power. Pharaoh in Egypt wasn't just a person that owns power. He didn't only represent God. He was a God himself. He was an incarnation of the Son. And with that in mind, I want to notice, how do the Egyptians react to Moshe doing the 10 plagues, doing the great drama that happened in Egypt? So, you would think that when God exposes his power to the Egyptians through the 10 plagues, the Egyptians would turn their backs to their politics and their theology and their paganism and start worshiping God. But that's not what they do. In one of the moments in the book of Exodus, this is in Exodus 11, verse 3, so it describes the awareness that the Egyptians were developing doing the 10 plagues. And this is what it says. V'ha'ish Moshe gadol me'od be'eretz Mitzrayim be'einei avdei paro uve'einei ha'am. This is an insight to the way the Egyptians were interpreting the drama of Exodus, the drama of the 10 plagues. How were they experiencing and interpreting the 10 plagues? V'ha'ish Moshe gadol me'od. They were glorifying the power of Moshe. So the Egyptians were still Egyptians. They worshipped Pharaoh. Now there's Exodus and miracles and the 10 plagues. So who are they worshipping now? Moshe. Because it's a way of seeing history, assuming that at the center of any dramatic event of history, there is a hero, there is a person, The modern representative of this way of thinking is Thomas Carlyle, but a pagan way of thinking is that in the heart of a great historic drama, there is a person that's performing these miracles. That was the Egyptian way of thinking. And by the way, it turns out it wasn't only the Egyptian way of thinking. Before the sin of Chet HaEgel, of the golden calf, we have an insight into the way the Hebrews were thinking. Why did the Hebrews, why did the people of Israel worship the golden calf? Why did they create the golden calf to begin with? Well, they actually say Moshe disappeared, right, into the mountains, and they're homesick, they miss Moshe, there's a vacuum of leadership, and they create the golden calf. And this is how they explain themselves. They say like this, Ze Moshe Ha'ish, Asher He'elanu Me'eretz Mitzrayim, Lo Yadanu Mahayalo. They're saying, Moshe, which took us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. So according to the people of Israel, who took Am Yisrael out of Mitzrayim? Who did that? Moshe, which means worshiping Moshe, worshiping the person. It starts with worshiping Pharaoh. The Egyptians have a tendency to glorify Moshe in the middle of Exodus, and it turns out also the people of Israel glorify Moshe. It was him that performs the miracle. It was him that took them out of Egypt. It was Moshe. Now, that's the Egyptian awareness of Moshe. That is the Egyptian influence that is shaping the experience of the people of Israel towards Moshe. And now we have the book of Deuteronomy. And the book of Deuteronomy, this is the only time where Moshe delivers his account of what really happened. Moshe tells the story of Exodus all over again. Now, this is interesting, because we know in history it happens many times when a hero of an event becomes the storyteller of that event. Winston Churchill had both roles. He was the hero of World War II, and he tried to be the historian of World War II. David Ben-Gurion was the hero of the formation of Israel, and then he tried to be the storyteller, the historian of the formation of Israel. Josephus Flavius had an important role in the time of destruction of the Second Temple. Then he tried to become the storyteller of destruction of the Second Temple. Great people try to assume both roles, to be the hero of the story and the teller of the story. When you're the hero of the story, you're forming the future. When you're the teller of the story, you're forming the past. And maybe that's the motivation of great people, to become not only heroes, but historians. Because they don't want only to control the future, they also want to control the memory of the past. The past, the story. And Moshe, in Exodus, in Shmot, Vayikra, Dvarim, in the last three books, he is in the center of the story, forming the future. And in Deuteronomy, he tells the story, forming the past, shaping memory. How does he shape memory? What does he do? So at least eight times in the book of Dvarim, he tells the story of Exodus all over again. He does the same thing every time. We're not going to go over all eight. We'll just taste the flavor of one. And I'm going to read from Deuteronomy chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 14. The context says, he tells the people of Israel that one day, when they enter Canaan, they'll be very successful and they'll forget God. They'll forget God that took them out of Egypt. And I'm reading from verse 14. V'ram levavcha v'shachachta et Adonai Elohecha ha-motzi'acha mi'eretz Mitzrayim mi'bet avadim ha-molichacha b'bidbar ha-gadol v'hanora נחש, שרף, ועקרב, וצמאון, אשר אין מים, המוציא לך מים, מצור החלמיש. In a nutshell, the story of Exodus has two pieces to it. One is escaping Egypt, and the second is wandering in the desert. And there are two different challenges. The challenge of Egypt is a challenge of a powerful civilization. The challenge of the desert is a challenge of no civilization. What's more terrifying? a powerful civilization or no civilization. If you want to formalize that, the power of the civilization is a threat to your liberty. The desert, no civilization, is a threat to your security. What do you rather, liberty or security? It's a great biblical question, and it's two different challenges. The challenge of slavery, not having liberty, and the challenge of not having water to drink, the challenge of the desert. And Moshe leads them through both challenges, from slavery to freedom, but with freedom comes uncertainty. He led them through all the challenges. That's the biography of Moshe. But how is it captured in his autobiography? How is it captured? It's captured like this. God took you out of Egypt. God led you through the desert. God bought water for you out of the rocks. It was never me. He does this 8 times. When Moshe tells the story of Exodus, he takes himself out of the story. This is an important motif of the book of Deuteronomy. Because usually, Flavius, Ben-Gurion, Churchill, all great men, all great people. But the tendency of storytellers, when the people tell the story of the story, that they were the heroes of the story, when they retell the story, it amplifies their role. When Moshe retells the story, he erases his role. Moshe takes himself out of the story. Sensitive readers of the Pesach Haggadah already noticed that in the Haggadah Shel Pesach, in the Haggadah, Moshe is not mentioned, or he's barely mentioned. Where we're commanded every year to tell the story of Exodus without the hero of the story. And we always find that interesting. How can you tell the story without the hero of the story? Well, it turns out the Haggadah wasn't the first text to do this. Sefer Dvarim was the first text to do this. The first person to erase Moshe was Moshe. And in that sense, we see the beginning of the cultural battle to take Egypt out of Israel. Ben-Gurion used to say, Yoter kal lehotzi et ha-Yehudim mehagalut, ma'asher lehotzi et ha-galut mehayehudim. It's easier to take the Jews out of exile than taking exile out of the Jews. I want to paraphrase that. I would say that one challenge was to take the Israelites out of Egypt. The second challenge is taking Egypt out of the Israelites. And taking Egypt out of the Israelites is trying to attack or challenge and neutralize the tendency to glorify the political leader. And the first attempt of Moshe to neutralize the tendency to glorify the political leader is to tell him the story where the political leader had no role in that story. The second thing that Moshe does, he doesn't only retell the story of his life. It's not only about how he reshapes the memory of his life. It's also about his death. Death is a big deal in the ancient Egyptian civilization. Actually, death is in the center of the culture. First of all, there's a whole mummification process. According to Egyptian theology, so first of all, mummies are really a tremendous trick with tremendous technological achievements. Scientists till today have a hard time understanding how they did that. They invested a lot in the techniques and the science and technology of mummification. But there was a theology here. The theology was that the only way that the person would achieve an afterlife is that their body is complete, externally complete. Like as opposed to the many Muslims and Christians and some Jews believe that what guarantees an afterlife is the completeness of your soul, for the Egyptians, it was a completeness of your body, of the external part of your body. So mummification was part of guaranteeing that the person in the mummy, that the soul in the mummy, will move on. A second piece in the great investment of the ancient Egyptian culture in death is obviously the pyramids. There's a great disagreement among scholars and archaeologists. What was the purpose of the pyramids? Because they're so impressive, not only in the way they're built, but also how accurate they are astronomically. And there's a belief that that's how you guarantee the afterlife. That's how you guarantee that the person in the pyramid will be sent to be a part of the stars, a part of the cosmic world. Did that work? I don't know. I do know that the pyramids are still there today. That even if it did or it didn't make sure that the pharaohs will be a part of the sky, their memory is still here on the ground. The pyramids are still here today. And finally, pharaohs, never the son of Pharaoh is Pharaoh, and the grandson of Pharaoh is Pharaoh. These are three ways of fighting death. Three ways of staying alive. Keeping the body externally perfect. Putting the body in a perfect monument. And creating an internal dynasty that carries, I wouldn't say it's your message, it's your name. Your name stays alive. Here are three things that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't do. One, and this is extremely shocking, his children did not inherit his power. Many times we learn from the Torah, from the Bible, the most important lessons are not what happened, but what didn't happen. And it's not obvious that Moshe did not create the Moshe dynasty. That's his first rebellion against the Egyptian culture. Two, as opposed to, let's say, Jacob and Yosef, his body didn't become a mummy. But what's more important, Mekom kvurato lo noda. No one knows where Moshe is buried. Creating the perfect antithesis to the Egyptian burial system. Not only that we don't have an internal monument, Moshe's grave completely disappeared. And by the way, it's also important that there is a direct verse that says that it disappeared and no one knows where it is. Because I guarantee you that if we wouldn't have had that verse, we would have had today a few burial sites of Moshe Rabbeinu. It's because there is a verse. There are no burial sites. Which means when Moshe, there is no body, no dynasty, and no grave. Moshe's death is his absolute disappearance. Moshe died an anti-Egyptian death. So when Moshe tells his Moshe takes his, he takes himself out of his story, doing his life, and he takes himself out of the future through his death. The book of Dvarim is the attempt of Moshe that was born as an Egyptian, raised as an Egyptian, to do everything he can to perform a rebellion against the Egyptian culture. It's easy to take Moshe took the Jews out of Egypt through doing his life, and he tried to take Egypt out of the Jews through his death, through the way that he chose to die. But it's not only that Moshe is not a part of the story. There's also an attempt the way Jewish tradition shapes the story. The story of Exodus has three parts to it. Leaving Egypt, wandering in the desert, and entering Eretz Yisrael. That was the vision of Abraham in Brit Ben HaBetarim. That was the way God described it to Moses in the burning bush. It's a two-part story. Leaving Egypt, entering the land, which turns into a three-part story because he spent way too much time, more than expected, in the desert. And that's the sacred story. That's Historia Sacra. That's the sacred story. And Jewish tradition is about reenacting that story. That's what we do. through. That's how the Hebrew calendar, the Jewish calendar, reflects sacred history. We relive the story. But if we look carefully, we realize something is missing here. We don't relive the complete story. We reenact Exodus in Pesach. And in Shabbat, and Exodus is a great moment, we reenact. We reenact wandering the desert, where we try to imitate the way they lived in the desert, the living conditions, when we live 7 days a week in Sukkot. Chazal even add a moment of reenacting Kabbalat HaTorah, which is Shavuot. But there is a missing chag, a missing festival in the Jewish calendar. What's the missing chag? Entering Eretz Knaan, entering the land of Israel. That's a moment in Jewish sacred history which is not reflected in the Jewish calendar. There's an asymmetry between history and calendar, which means we're only reenacting two-thirds of the story, but an entire part of the story is a part of our story, but not a part of what, it's not the part that we celebrate about our story. I would like to argue this is also a part of creating an anti-Egyptian awareness. We're celebrating the moment where we achieved independence, not the moment where we conquered Eretz Canaan. Conquering Canaan is an important moment. It was a needed moment, but it's not a celebrated moment. The missing chag of the Jewish calendar is also an important moment in the Jewish calendar. Because the calendar educates us not only by what we celebrate, but also what we don't celebrate. I don't think it's a pacifistic move. We need power. Power is important. Power is not something that we reject, but we don't celebrate it. The Egyptian world was a world of celebrating power and was a world of worshiping the people who own power. The Jewish calendar doesn't celebrate power. It celebrates liberty. And it doesn't worship the people who own power. Moshe Rabbeinu tried to shape Jewish memory that way by taking the leader out of the story through his life and taking him out of awareness through his death. Thank you. God wants justice. He wants morality. He wants ethics. He's not interested in sacrifice.